But if everything works out, the mayor should be here around 1 o'clock. So our schedule itself for the symposium workshops tomorrow will change a little bit. He won't be here. He'll be up in the, just above you in the student cafeteria, which is where we'll have him on. I'll let you know more tomorrow morning, but just keep that in mind in your schedules if you're able to come. For those of you who are not the fellows, of course, fellows will be here. And yes, here we are. This is the crime report that should be familiar to all of you. I want to bring up Graham Cates, our deputy managing editor. We have a really amazing story up there this morning. I mentioned it to some of the fellows last night. It's written by a contributing editor for the Crime Report, Dave Krycek, and it's very, very germane to some of the things we're talking about at this conference, particularly tomorrow. We'll be talking about some of the systemic problems of the criminal justice system and how to report on them and how to deal with them. Dave Krycek spent about a year on a grant from the National Investigative Journalism Fund looking at people who are wrongfully convicted for second-tier crimes, felonies, burglaries. We all know about the work of the Innocence Project and how it works with DNA to free innocent people from jail, from death row. But apparently there's a huge numbers of people, of Americans around the country, who regularly go to jail or get convicted for crimes they didn't commit, but because of the way the system works, nothing ever happens to them. They can never get justice. Dave has done a fantastic long-form piece of journalism that looks at it and has some really good estimates, which are pretty authoritative. So, Graham, do you want to talk a little bit about the long form and how they can download it and stuff, and then we'll just move on to the panel?
It's up today on our site, so if you go to www.thecrimereport.org and you have half an hour or so at some point, take a look at it. It's really an incredible story. And as everyone knows, I mean, going to prison can ruin your life, and the estimates in this story are that 50,000 people every year are wrongfully convicted. And so if you want to share it with people on Twitter, we really want to get kind of the word out about this story. He worked on it for about a year. And also, if you're tweeting from this conference, we mentioned it before, but Justice2015 is the hashtag we're using, and we're kind of following it along as we go.
Thank you, Greg. So when we began organizing the conference, in fact, when we began organizing the panel you just heard, we were, of course, thinking about what happened in Ferguson, what happened in Cleveland, what happened here in New York. But we hadn't known that the president was going to pick a task force on 21st century policing and pick some of our panelists who were here. So I'm glad he must have been reading our initial agenda. But we were not just wanting to concentrate on policing and the problems of policing and police-community relations, though obviously that's a key part of the picture, but we also wanted to widen our perspective, to look at the full scope of what's going on in these poor urban communities, most of them minority communities, where so much of what has been happening in the last, so many of the questions that have been raised in the last 6 months have taken place. And so this panel is kind of a follow-on for that. We wanted to harden it a bit with looking at some of the statistical data that people have come up with and some of the really cutting-edge studies that have happened. Traditionally, this panel, which we call Criminal Justice Trends, is a look at the crime picture for the previous year and a look ahead. And we usually begin with one of the country's most distinguished and foremost criminologists, Professor Al Bloomstein of Carnegie Mellon. His bio is in your agenda packet. And then we have another two panelists who are going to join him who've gone a bit further and will also talk about some interesting stuff that they've developed and discovered in the course of their research over the last year. So I'm not going to spend a lot of time trying to introduce them. They're in your bio, but we're going to start with Al, who I think you'll find a great intro into what we've been looking at, what's going on over the past year. So Al, I'll take it over to you, and then we'll start.
Let me just start, Steve had asked, to talk about something about crime trends, as well as an issue that I think is very much up in the air, and that is punishment trends. So let me start with the issue of crime. And I want to focus on murder and robbery, my two favorite crimes, partly because they're well-defined and partly because they're well-reported. As you get to the other crimes that are the typically reported ones, larceny just covers an enormous territory, and unfortunately people often add larceny with other things, and so any change in anything else is just swamped by changes in larceny. Aggravated assault is clearly an important crime, but there's so much discretion on what's aggravated and what's less than aggravated. Forcible rape is undergoing lots of change in lots of ways. So that we're seeing lots of change. So let me at least focus on that. And this is the picture from 1972 through 2013. And I think there's some interesting stories that highlight the different trends that show up and the different factors that move things up and down. What I want to do is look at the peaks and the troughs in that changing graph. So, and talk about some of the factors that have contributed to it. Starting with that 1980 peak, which is predominantly a demographic peak. The baby boomers, the peak of them was in 1960. By 1980, that peak was moving through the high crime ages, which are the late teens, early 20s. And so crime started coming down after 1980, and that was kind of neat. Until you see the trough in about 1985, when things started getting worse in murder and robbery. And that was crack started showing up in the early 80s. We were very aggressive about getting crack dealers off the street into prison. And one of the themes about thinking about drug crimes and drug incarceration, in contrast, for example, to the rapist, when you take the rapist off the street, you take his rapes off with him. When you take a drug seller off the street, you typically will recruit a replacement as a substitute for his function in the demand-driven marketplace. So that the replacements, it turned out, were much more young people who were far less restrained in their handling guns that they had to carry because of street robbers, so that we saw a rise in murder and robbery associated with the arrival, with the growth in that crack market, with the kids being recruited, and guns, not only the kids in the market, but their buddies in the street. And so we saw a major rise in violence, particularly young African-American males who were the people running that crack market. And that peaked in the early 90s when the taste for crack started coming down. There was a robust economy so that those kids could had other opportunities. And there was a pretty aggressive activity by police in capturing those guns. And we saw a growing incapacitation effect because while the violence by young people had been going up during that period, the homicide rates by people under 20 more than doubled for all of those ages. But the people over 30, the homicide rate was coming down. Largely an incapacitation effect. So we saw both things going on at that point. And so we saw crime drop, about a 45% drop in murder and robbery. That was the thrust of the book that Joel Wallman and I edited in about 2000, revised somewhat later by adding what happened since. But with a wide variety of authors pointing out the different effects of incarceration, of deterrence, of incapacitation, of drug markets, and so on. So that we saw that drop, and the drop pretty much stopped in 2000. Starting in 2000, we saw pretty much a flat period that ran until about 2009. 2008, 2009, when we saw that decline pick up again, and we haven't heard very much about the decline because the media are much more, if it bleeds, it leads. And if it's becoming nicer, we don't get that much play. And I can tell you that the early word on 2014, the first half of 2014, came out with a drop of 6% in homicide and a drop of 10% in robbery. And that I didn't see any press reports of that striking increment of the two crimes that really trouble people most, of murder and robbery, so that as we go to 2014, things seem to be continuing to get better, and it's many of the subtleties that raise concerns. At the same time, then, I want to move on from crime to punishment to incarceration and talk about some of the trends going on there. And it's a particularly interesting area because there was this very important and extremely well-done panel that Jeremy Travis chaired for the National Academy of Sciences looking at mass incarceration, this phenomenal growth of incarceration in the United States, and without too much attention to what we could do about it. But what's particularly interesting about incarceration today is that in this highly polarized political environment, it's the one issue on which the left and the right seem to agree, perhaps for different reasons, but both seem to agree we want to get incarceration rates down. And let's see how it's going. And this is work I did with Alan Beck of the Bureau of Justice Statistics, a paper that Jeremy Travis's panel asked us to do on the growth of incarceration, factors contributing to it, and so on. So let me give you some history. This goes back to 1925 to 75, 50 years worth. And a paper that I did with Jacqueline Cohen looked at the incarceration rate over that period, and it was 110 per 100,000 population. That is 0.11% of the U.S. population was in prison pretty much steady. And it was a criminal justice system that was very much under the control of the people who ran the criminal justice system. If they had too many prisoners coming in the front door, they'd open the back door a little wider and put people out on parole more readily. If there was lots of slack in the capacity, then they might crack down on pornography or other things that they didn't feel intensely about. But there was accommodation, a homeostatic process at work that maintained that rather stable rate. There was a bit of a peak towards the end of the Depression when crime was going up, a little trough during World War II when we had better uses for young men, but an impressively stable period for 50 years from the 20s to the 70s. That gave rise to this theory of the stability of punishment that accommodated this homeostatic process, recognizing that the system was under their control. And when you look at the next 50 years, you see that very stable process that prevailed through the 70s, and that's about when this paper was written, went up from 110 to 500 per 100,000, an astonishing growth, predominantly in the 80s and 90s, and relatively flat and a bit of tapering down up to 2013. So what I want to do is start looking at some of the components in that. And this is a graph of the six crime types that comprise about 80% of the of that prison population. And you can see that just about everything is going up, but what you see is this dramatic change in this graph, which is the drug crimes, the drug prisoners, and this dramatic growth by a factor of 10, starting in 1980, peaking in about around 2000. And what you see also is that relatively flat rates on all of these crimes that were going up rather dramatically over that period between 1980 and 2000, and then this flat period after that. Let's look at the two pieces of the incarceration process. And we're talking now about prisons, the state prisons. Jails also have been tracking prisons at about 50% of the prison rate. But the focus here is going to be on the incarceration itself. Down at the bottom is the federal rate, which has been going up rather steadily. The state rate, which went up rather dramatically and has been, again, fairly flat since 2000, and so the total has been close to the state. But you don't get the difference between the federal and the state with this enormous difference in the range. So what I've done is multiply the federal rate by a factor of 10 so that you get the pattern of the changing rate in the federal system compared to the state system. And what you see, what you see is both of them going up pretty much at the state rate, at the same rate, but the states in 2000, this vertical line is at 2000, the states have impressively flattened out. Starting in 2000, before the budget crunch of 08, for example, so that the states, recognizing that they were just moving too fast, too far, but the feds didn't have the same sense of budget and other uses because, in effect, the feds have an infinite budget. The states, in large part, have to balance their budgets, so that the states started slowing down in 2000, and it goes fairly flat. That's about 230, 240. And has stayed pretty much there. And the interesting twist was in 2013 when the feds finally came down, and it was delightful to see the president in his State of the Union address say that prison rates are coming down. Well, for the first time, the federal rate came down, but the states went up a bit, and went up a bit larger so that the total prison population went up a little bit more in 2013, so that we're seeing this stability in the states, and the feds finally starting to get concerned about their incarceration rate. The Attorney General is moving in a variety of ways to shape that up, but we're seeing this very flatness in the states, and so the good news, of course, in the states is that the rise has stopped. It's been flat at about 430 since 2000, a little bit up and a little bit down, but impressively flat. And, of course, the bad news, number one, we are now the world leader in incarceration. If you count jails, we're at about 750 per 100,000. Or if you divide it, as Pew has highlighted, if you divide it by the adult population, roughly 1% of the adults in the U.S. are in prison on any given day. the closest behind us is Russia with about 500 some odd per 100,000. So that we have gone way beyond where anyone wants to be. But we appear to have been locked in at this new normal of about 500 per 100,000. And everyone agrees we ought to do something about it, but we haven't seen anything significant happen. So the new challenge is how do we get back towards that 110 per 100,000 in contrast to most of the other industrial nations in the world who are in the range of 75 to 150. Some are above that, some are below it. But that's sort of a norm that we should look to, which talks about a decrease of about 75%. In order to think about it, it warrants going back and looking at what are the factors that contributed to the rise. And this is something that Alan Beck and I have been working at for a number of years now. And basically, how much of that rise is attributable to more crime? How much of it is attributable to better policing, more arrests per crime? How much of it is attributable to decisions by prosecutors, by judges, of more commitments per arrest? And how much is attributable to longer time served by those who are sent to prison? And what you can see from the bold face in that, it's hardly attributable to more crime. It's hardly attributable to more arrests per crime. The two major contributors were the more commitments per arrest and the time served. Time served as a function of the sentence that the judges deliver, the sentences that are negotiated with the prosecutor in a plea bargain, and the parole boards, parole authorities, in when you let people out and when you send them back in because they're violating parole, either because of a new crime or on a technical violation. So that we see those two components is where the attention really has to be drawn in terms of finding ways to move it. So, the focus has got to be first on reducing the commitments per arrest and the time served, as well as the drug issue, which has been a driving force in the prison situation, and about 20%, a little less, in the states, and about 50% of the federal prison population. An astonishing 50% of the whole federal prison population is committed to people who've committed drug offenses. And obviously that large number can't be just the kingpins who are being targeted. And so many of them are relatively low drug dealers who need much more in the way of therapy rather than incarceration. And in our efforts to deal with the drug problem resulted in very long sentences, in many cases for people who are merely mules driving a car from point A to point B at the request of somebody else and got 20-year sentences, even though they may have had a prior record, and I know one of them. The policy implications, therefore, as let's reduce the commitments per arrest, and there's a whole variety of alternatives to prison that are now being looked at in various reduce the time served, and particularly parole violation as a major consideration in that time served. Rethink the drug war, and it's fascinating that the acting director of the Office of National Drug Control Policy is a recovering alcoholic who appreciates the degree to which this is a public health issue rather than inherently a criminal justice issue, but with a realization that criminal justice has an authority to compel response that can be used, but the issue of treatment is not strongest within the criminal justice system. is strongest in the public health environment, and that's where we ought to pay attention. And so much of it is embedded in statute that limits the flexibility. And I've had a number of interactions with legislators who really agree that we ought to drop prison population. But what about sunsetting or repealing some of those mandatory sentencing laws that they passed during the peak of the 80s and 90s? And, oh, no, they're not willing to do that because they're concerned that the voters will see, or their opponents in the next election will see them as soft on crime and target them for what they've done. So there's clearly much that needs to be done. And this is a whole array of approaches to reducing the commitments per arrest, repeal or sunset the mandatory sentencing laws, and especially those relating to drugs. Build the probation capacity to expand more effective use of probation, much more in the way of community treatment. Risk assessment instruments. 30 years ago, there were proposals to get risk assessment of who are the people who are at higher risk of committing the most numbers of crimes per year. No one would tolerate that because of disparity that would introduce. Today, you see every sentencing commission is dealing with risk assessment because they want to find ways to get into the prisons, the people who are the higher risk, get out of the prisons, the people who are the lower risk, so that they don't suffer an increase of crime, which would give rise to the people arguing we've got to be more punitive, and the public is not sensitive and not sophisticated enough to sort out the different kinds of crimes that are for which prison is more or less effective, the different kinds of offenders that for which prison is more or less effective. Risk assessment instruments, substance abuse rehabilitation services, and particularly the mentally ill. When you look at the populations that the criminal justice system deals with today, you've got drug abuse, drug addicts, you've got DUI alcoholics, you've got mentally ill, people who are much more heavily public health problems. An increasing fraction of the population in the criminal justice system for which the criminal justice system is least well equipped for dealing. Okay, time served, reduce the recommitment of parolees. Many of you know about the HOPE experiment where the judge in Hawaii initiated a program rather than send parole violators, particularly technical parole violators who were using drugs, tested for drugs, found to be tested positive. He said, okay, we're going to have a weekly test of you, and rather than send you back to prison for 7 months, we'll put you in the local jail for 3 days, and the second time we do it, we'll put you in jail for 5 days, and found impressive reduction in that violation of drug abuse. Local versions of HOPE and Sobriety 24/7. HOPE was focused on drugs. Sobriety is in the Dakotas, focused on alcoholism and the DUI. I was struck. We were looking at people sentenced to the Allegheny County Jail, the county around Pittsburgh, and found that 1/3 of the people sentenced to the jail were sentenced for DUI. It's a reflection not so much of alcoholism, but the growing mandatory sentences that the mad ladies seem to have been able to get legislators to impose. Following any particular accident that was caused, serious accident caused by a person who's under the influence of alcohol. Approaches, what we're getting older populations, people are staying much longer, finding ways to release them when they have no longer any risk in the community, represent no threat, releasing the no-risk lifers, and seek opportunities for the released offenders to participate in supervised public service functions, a need that is greater and increasing. And these are people who, in many respects, represent a good opportunity with credibility in the communities they're in. And, of course, the drug offenses, recognizing that incarcerating the drug offenders is recruiting the replacements for the community, using public health services for treatments, and some of the ill-timed, ill-advised attempts to think we could solve the drug problem with increasingly tough mandatory sentences started with 2-year mandatories and then 5-year, then 10-year, and particularly the distinction between crack cocaine and powder cocaine that introduced a racial disparity. So lots of the legislation that really needs rethinking and passing, and a few states are doing that, but most of them are just reluctant to move on it. And the Attorney General Holder, who said, hey, so much of this ill abuse is done by trying to count the weight, particularly if someone was driving a car as a mule, stop counting the weight and figure who this guy is and what's his role in the market. I want to thank you for this and get you started on thinking about how we can move the system forward. Thank you.
Thanks, Al. So before we move on, I just want to make a special note, which I should have said at the beginning, that for, as you all know, this is our 10th anniversary year for the Guggenheim. And for the past 10 years, Al Bloomstein has been anchoring our conference with his Criminal Justice Trends report. So I want to have a special shout out for Al for how he's been attracted. He's been a real great. So moving on, we have Professor Rick Rosenfeld, who's the founder's professor of criminology and criminal justice at the University of Missouri, St. Louis, whose research is focused on crime trends, statistics, and policing, all of which are right on top of the agenda right now. The rest of his bio is in your agenda books. Rick?
Thank you. I'm going to return in my remarks to Ferguson. I live really quite close to Ferguson. It's where we eat most often. We shop. Bike shop is there. And as Bill Freibogel mentioned in his remarks, and as I'm going to stress, if we want to begin to understand the Michael Brown incident. Not all tragic officer-involved shootings, but those that fall into that category. We have to understand Ferguson as, first and foremost, a suburb. Ferguson, as Bill, I think, put it quite well, is a racially integrated, quite diverse socioeconomically, and in recent years, growing suburb of the city of St. Louis. So I want to put Ferguson in some context. The question comes up all the time, why Ferguson? And the answer often is, well, why not? I want to raise that question by putting Ferguson in context and then return to it. In the city of St. Louis, and in fact, we saw this alluded to in other comments this morning, there is a concern that crime rises in the city of St. Louis are linked to what is commonly in the area called a Ferguson effect. And people have various ways of interpreting that relationship. I want to explore it a bit with you. I've participated in a study with my colleague David Klinger on officer-involved shootings in the city of St. Louis, and I want to discuss some of the major findings from that and then bring them back to bear on Ferguson and ask, well, why not Ferguson? if you listen to protesters, not only in St. Louis but elsewhere, you hear quite often people talking about expanding the narrative. And I agree we should expand the narrative, but I'd like to suggest we expand it in ways that haven't really received a great deal of attention. One way we have to expand the narrative is by expanding the data on which people claim to make their arguments about doing this or that with respect to police reform, reducing officer-involved shootings, improving community police relations, and so forth. So why Ferguson? Here's Ferguson. There's the city of St. Louis. Familiar with the city, the arch would be right here. That's the Mississippi River. Here's the city line. St. Louis City is a very, very constricted geographically in the broader area. This is St. Louis County. This is north. This is south. And the census tracts are shaded according to the fraction of the population, black or African American. So you see that the St. Louis area, St. Louis City, but the area generally remains racially segregated, with the African American population concentrated in the northern part of the city and in the northern suburbs, and the white population concentrated more in the southern part of the city and in the central and southern St. Louis suburbs. So I want to give you a sense of just how close Ferguson is to the city and why people in the city, as crime rates were going up, homicide in particular, might have supposed that the events in Ferguson and ensuing protests were influencing crime in the city nearby. Here's the demographic context, at least in a few indicators. You see that the Ferguson, relatively small suburb, about 21,000. St. Louis County, of which it's a part, is just about a million population. St. Louis City, which is not part of St. Louis County, which is a separate county, if you will, somewhat like Baltimore, just under 320,000. Ferguson, two-thirds black, one-third white. As recently as 2000, Ferguson was half black, half white, so there has been, if you will, racial recomposition of Ferguson. But that change really came to a halt some years ago. Ferguson has, up until the Michael Brown shooting, we'll see what happens now, Ferguson has remained, or I should say probably become, a rather stable, racially integrated neighborhood. The unemployment rate in, St. Louis County, a quarter black, St. Louis City, half and half, Ferguson in the middle. Unemployment rate in Ferguson, again, in the middle, though somewhat close to the high unemployment rate in St. Louis City than the somewhat lower unemployment rate in St. Louis County. These data are from 2009-2013, so they encompass the so-called Great Recession, which is why you see these elevated unemployment rates. Poverty rate in Ferguson, 25%, a little lower in the city, but not much, compared to 11% in the county. So demographically, Ferguson is in the middle between the city and the county, but somewhat closer on these dimensions to the city than to the county. But what about crime rates? Here are homicide, all violent crime rates, and property crime rates. And these are per 1,000 population. If it were per 100,000, we'd have a homicide rate of just over 9 per 100,000 in Ferguson, compared to about a little under four for St. Louis County. That's not far below the current national average, and compared to just under 38 per 100 in the city of St. Louis. With respect to homicide and violent crime, Ferguson is much closer to St. Louis County than it is to the city of St. Louis. Even though we saw demographically, Ferguson appears to resemble more the city of St. Louis than St. Louis County. With respect to property crime, Ferguson is in the middle. But with respect to violent crime, Ferguson is elevated over St. Louis County, but far lower than in the city of St. Louis. So is there a Ferguson effect on crime in St. Louis? We heard earlier today that after community unrest in Cincinnati for several years, crime rates were elevated in Cincinnati. After the community unrest in St. Louis and all around St. Louis, I should say, there was concern that a homicide increase in St. Louis could be attributed to a so-called Ferguson effect. Homicides in St. Louis went up by over 30% from 2013 to 2014, a sizable rise off an already sizable base. You heard earlier this morning that in Kansas City, homicide dropped by a little over 20%. So, not unreasonable for people to link the homicide rise to the events of Ferguson. What would the nature of the linkage be? Well, some people would argue as police are taken off normal patrol routine to address protest activity, and as police have to, in effect, shut down proactive policing to address protest activity, those dislocations in policing generate more opportunities for crime. You get crime rises as a result. Some people have argued that police are tired or angry or frustrated, and they engage in individual-level de-policing. They don't police as assertively or as aggressively. Other people have argued that young people in particular, young men in the community, become angry and frustrated over those events and take matters into their own hands to a degree they might not have otherwise, and crime rises. Well, let's look at what I did here is just put up the monthly homicide counts in the city of St. Louis. I'm losing it here. In the city of St. Louis for 2013 and 2014. You see, they both are going up through the year, during both years. It's hard to tell, really, though, whether 4, and it looks like 14 is a bit above 13. Here's the month-to-month ratio of the number of homicides in 14 divided by the number of homicides in 13. Michael Brown was killed on August 9th. But as you see, homicides were trending up in the city of St. Louis prior to Michael Brown's killing. And in fact, earlier in the year, the ratio of 14 homicides were considerably higher than 13. So that increase continues over time, but it's hard for me, at least, to square the timing of the homicide increase with the idea that it's been brought about primarily by an effect of the Ferguson killing and ensuing protest. The timing isn't quite right. For other violent crime, I'll go right to the ratio. Somewhat of a mixed story, I think, though again, we see the same pattern. It's earlier in the year where violent crime in 14 is really above 13. And then it begins coming back up, but again, well before the Michael Brown shooting. But the rate of increase appears to go up a bit, so maybe there's some Ferguson effect there. What did I do? And let me look at property crime now. Again, the same kind of ratios. Here, at least the timing seems to be more consistent. Property crime in 2014 running below 2013 until you get to the Michael Brown shooting, and then you see property crimes in 14 running above 13. So if there is a Ferguson effect, at least the timing would suggest it's probably more likely to have affected property crime than homicide. Property crimes citywide in St. Louis did not go up for the year over 13. They were up, however, a couple of months at the end of 14 compared to the same period, the end of 13. So is there a Ferguson effect on crime? Perhaps, but perhaps not the crime that many thought might be most responsive, serious violence or homicide. I've been engaged, as I said, in research on officer-involved shootings in the city of St. Louis. I wish I had time to go into that research in some detail, but I don't. I'm just going to give you the bottom line, and I'm happy to talk about it and share our results in much greater detail. As some of you may know, it's been in the news. Wall Street Journal did a good, I thought, investigative piece on the quality of the data we have available to measure change over time in police shootings that end in someone's death. Those official counts really substantially understate the degree of the number each year of officer-involved shootings that end in an individual's death. And even if they didn't understate it, they understate officer-involved shootings by a large margin because most officer-involved shootings don't lead to any individual death. In the city of St. Louis, in our study over the last 10 years, about 16% of officer-involved shootings. These are incidents in which the officer does discharge his or her firearm. About 16% involve death to suspect. About half involve are incidents in which someone is wounded. So even if the official counts were accurate, they would still badly understate officer-involved shootings. Dead bodies are a poor indicator of deadly force. James Fife made this point years and years ago. When officers shoot, they shoot for center mass. They are shooting not technically to kill, but to stop a threat. And if you're shooting to center mass, you are very likely engaged in lethal or potentially lethal violence. So every time an officer shoots at someone, we should want to know about it. We have absolutely no national level or state level or local level data on that, except for the isolated research projects such as ours and a few others that actually go out and obtain the information from local police departments. And prior research in this area has also been done at the state level or the city level, and arguably those aggregations are too large, they're too heterogeneous to give you a good sense of the dynamics of these incidents. So what we did, we studied all the intentional officer-involved shootings in the city of St. Louis over that recent 10-year period. They average about between 20 and 25 a year. And we located each one in a neighborhood of the city of St. Louis. Most neighborhoods, not surprisingly, had none. About a quarter of neighborhoods had one shooting over that period. 10% had two, and a relatively small proportion had three or more officer-involved shootings. Here is another picture of the city of St. Louis. There's the city line. There would be the arch. There's the northern part of the city, the southern part of the city. And what I've done here is shaded the neighborhoods by the level of firearm violence in the neighborhood, right? Homicide, firearm assault, firearm robbery. And the dots represent officer-involved shooting. And we can see officer-involved shootings tend to concentrate in areas with high levels of firearm violence. On this map, it's very much like the one I showed you earlier, the neighborhoods are shaded by the fraction of the neighborhood that is black or African American. And again, officer-involved shootings are represented by the dots, and we see officer-involved shootings also concentrated in predominantly black neighborhoods, though I should point out that there are a non-trivial number in neighborhoods that are relatively more affluent and where whites tend to live. So here's what we found. What's driving at the neighborhood level? The frequency of incidents in which an officer discharges his or her firearm at a suspect. And by far, in a way, the factor that emerges is the level of firearm violence in the neighborhood. The more firearm violence, the more likely it is that a police shooting will occur in that neighborhood, up to a point, after which the most violent neighborhoods tend to have fewer police shootings than those neighborhoods that are somewhat in the middle. And we checked and rechecked and rechecked to confirm that finding. For St. Louis, we're convinced, we don't know because we have no data for other places. We don't know if this is generalizable. The frequency of officer-involved shootings is at a maximum in neighborhoods with mid-levels of firearm violence in the city. Now, why might that be? We don't know if this nonlinear effect will hold in other places. We suspect, though, as we've thought about this, that in the most violent neighborhoods, One tends to have more officers who are more experienced and more alert to the dangers of the job, and perhaps as a result, less likely to make the kinds of errors that officers who work in areas that are, you know, with some level of violence perhaps, but not at acute levels, officers who are less experienced, less mindful of their environment, who are apt to make more of errors, engage in behavior that contradicts their own training, and so forth. So we may have more mindful officers in the more dangerous neighborhoods, and indeed we may also have somewhat savvier suspects who have an awareness that in encounters with the police, they could be badly injured or killed, and to some degree behave accordingly. Now, those are our speculations about why we find officer-involved shootings somewhat less frequent in the most violent neighborhoods. There's a lot of room for more research. Now, go back and think about Ferguson. Ferguson has violent crime rates that are higher than the St. Louis County average. They're not zero, but they're far lower than what one finds in the city of St. Louis on average. Indeed, the violent crime rates in Ferguson are quite similar to those mid-levels of violent crime one sees in the city of St. Louis. I'm assuming you've read about or heard about Officer Wilson's grand jury testimony and other evidence associated with Officer Wilson's behavior in Ferguson. Whatever your view of Officer Wilson's behavior, it's absolutely indisputable that he violated important protocols with respect to chain of custody of evidence and with respect to the handling of evidence. He was supposed to have called out to his supervisor and remained on the scene until his supervisor arrived on the scene. He did not. That's standard protocol across police departments. He was supposed to have, under a supervisor's supervision, returned to the station house and not washed his hands, which is immediately what he did when he turned to the station house, washing blood off his hands, DNA evidence. He was not supposed to have taken his own firearm and placed it into evidence. That was supposed to have been taken by somebody with custody of property and evidence, wearing gloves, removing the firearm, also evidence, and placing it in a sealed container. None of that happened. All of which suggests not necessarily malice on Officer Wilson's part, but inexperience. Ferguson is a suburb. Ferguson police, those 55 police officers, do not go on patrol every day thinking they're going to have violent encounters with suspects. They are inexperienced at that. They're woefully inexperienced in dealing with protest activity. We know that. They're also inexperienced in dealing in violent encounters with suspects. So I could go on and on, but I think you get my point. Let me just say this. As we expand the narrative, I think it is important. Obviously, better training is needed, and reducing implicit bias of all kinds is important. But I think we need to get beyond simple individual-level remedies. Violence is not easy. It is not. It may appear so given recent incidents. Violence is not easy for police officers to perpetrate. It's not easy for violent criminals to engage in. Violence is difficult. Part of the difficulty comes from the fact that interpersonal violence necessarily means it's an interaction among two or more people. We need to understand the interactional conditions that give rise to police shootings to a much greater degree than we do now. The reason we don't have any understanding now is we have absolutely no evidence. There is no national level database to which you as reporters can go to find out about the kinds of circumstances that might distinguish police shootings and end in someone's death from those that do not, might distinguish police shootings in which the suspect or victim, if you will, is armed with a firearm or not armed with a firearm. We have no such evidence. And as a result, all of us speak not knowing what we're talking about when we speak on this issue, not because we're silly or stupid, but because we're ignorant. And we're ignorant because we don't have evidence. And if there's one thing I'd like to leave you with is we badly need that evidence. We need it. We don't need simply to count up the dead bodies. We need evidence that would enable us to understand the circumstances of these events so we can reduce their frequency. Thank you.
Thanks, Rick. So we'll move right along to Professor Karen Martin. Of our own John Jay, who's going to take us into another dimension of both policing in a town like Ferguson and similar towns. Karen is an assistant professor at John Jay's Department of Public Management. She studied psychology at Stanford University, and the rest of her bio is in your packets. Thank you, Karen.
Morning. This is a well-organized, well-sequenced panel, because I'm going to do a little national and a little local. The first trend I'd like to talk about is actually the use of criminal justice financial obligations at the national level. And what you can see is there's actually been a threefold increase, and this is billions, with a B as in the silent letter in debt, right? And how often at the federal level we use fines and restitution. And this is every monetary penalty the federal system uses. And just to be clear, fines are part of your sentence. Restitution happens when there's an identifiable victim and when there's some specific bodily or property harm. And there's also fees, so that's court costs, probation fees, supervision fees, et cetera, et cetera. And so you can see that we are in an era of using quite a significant number of criminal justice financial obligations. You can see this is actually a national trend. So since 2010, almost every state has increased or expanded either the number or the magnitude of the criminal justice financial obligations that they have on the books. Of the 15 states with the largest prison population, is that good? All of the states that were in this study, which is done by the Brennan Center of Justice, all of them have some fee that occurs because you're convicted. All of them have some type of fees for being on supervision, probation, or parole. And all of them have laws that will put you back in jail or prison for failing to pay your criminal justice debt. And finally, in the past 20 years ago, only 7 states had a law in the book saying that you had to pay for indigent defense. And now we're up to 43 jurisdictions, 43 states have a law in the book saying that if you can't afford an attorney, you know that statement, you actually have to pay for it. And that fee can be hundreds of dollars. And what you see in New York is similar. So in New York metropolitan area, 47% of the criminal court revenue comes from these criminal justice financial obligations, and it's split between the state and the city. The courts themselves finance themselves through criminal justice financial obligations. You can see that they had a budget of $31 million, and of that, 12.6 came from fines. Now, what's interesting is that just because we have these laws on the books and people are assessed these things, there is a huge amount of debt that's outstanding. More than $300 million is actually owed for CJFOs at the federal level. And if you look at, there's actually a report that said, on average, every state has something almost $200 million in uncollected debt from criminal justice financial obligations. And that's really important because debt, as I'm going to talk about a little bit later, affects every aspect of your life if you have significant criminal justice debt. In New York, there's actually a variety of statutes. So there's a fee, $250 surcharge for every felony, $250 if you have a DWI. If you're on probation or parole, you are charged $30 a month with some discretion to your officer. If you're in prison, it's at least a dollar a week. And if you may know that when you're working in prison, you make 15 cents perhaps, sometimes $2. So that's a significant amount of money. In New York, the restitution is mandated. And it's $15,000, and people, of course, there's exceptions to that, but there's a law in the book saying that there's always restitution to be paid for a felony, $15,000. And importantly, in Ferguson, the debt was a simmering issue, right? People were being caught up by police because they had outstanding warrants, because they hadn't paid the debt. And in Ferguson, it was 20% of the city's $32 million budget was from fines and fees and restitution being paid. And this shift is happening because I think in 2010 it was only 20% of their budget, and now we're up to 40% of their budget. Now I want to go, so something maybe a little bit daring, a little bit towards the world of theory, just because this theoretical question of how we should use prison in combination with fines actually has very kind of urgent and critical questions, because criminologists care about theory and policymakers do to a certain extent. And just to make this kind of brief, so we could live in a world where fines were an alternative to prison. And in fact, the reason we have so many fines on the books now is because they were originated, they became very popular during. The idea was that if you could give somebody something that's punitive and yet costless, ideally, to the state, you could keep them out of prison, which is, everybody knows, very expensive. So the idea is more fines and fees, less prison. Now, what we also could see is that fines actually supplement prison. So we want to be extra punitive, you're going to get both. And I think the reality tends to flex some combination of the two. And the theme of my presentation is that we don't actually know the extent to which this is the case, how everything, extra legal factors, race, education, income, affect where you fall on this chart. Some people, I'm sure, are familiar with the federal sentencing guidelines. So in the federal level, every conviction mandates some type of fine, and as I said, that's part of your sentence, right? And this is based on your offense level. It does not take into account criminal history, which if you go to prison, it does take into account criminal history. So when you get a monetary penalty at the federal level, and you have one of these offense levels, that is the range of the fine you're supposed to be assessed. You know, of course, things like murder down here, so there's some larceny is kind of in the middle, depending. Trespassing might be kind of low. And I don't want to hurt your eyes too much with this. If you're familiar with federal sentencing guidelines, you may see that this is, I have six kind of dots for every criminal history score, and along the bottom, every offense level. And the main point of this graph is to show you that there is a lot of variability in the use of monetary penalties, much more so than prison. And because this is based on criminal history and everything else, that raises the question of how are we deciding which monetary penalties to use and for whom? In general, you know, you see that, of course, it makes sense. As your offense becomes more severe, you're more likely to have a longer prison sentence, right? Those are the green dots. And for monetary sanctions, however, there's kind of scattered, right? There's not a strong correlation there. You can ask the same question with likelihood, right? So again, your likelihood of going to prison makes sense as you have a more severe offense, you're more likely to go to prison. But with monetary penalties, these blue dots, it's actually kind of decreasing, but again, there's a lot more variability, right? Those dots are not adhering strictly, very closely to that line. I just want to talk a little bit about how people kind of navigate this world of debt. You can, and this is based on some data I'm collecting right now in two New York counties. First, of course, a judge assesses you a criminal justice financial obligation. Ideally, an electronic record is created, but I'm finding that actually there's, in some systems, there is no electronic database. That's right, there is zero electronic database to actually tell people what they owe. If you go to jail or prison, your criminal justice debt is just taken automatically out of your commissary, and people have strategies for having, you know, their friends and family members put money in their phone account versus their commissary because there's different rules regulating what the state has access to. The debtor then goes to pay to at a court, right? Ideally, the clerk's office tracks the payment, and the probation officer is the one who tracks non-payment. And the probation officer is the one who, if you are not paying, tries to work with you to make a payment plan. If that doesn't work, then the probation officer has the authority to issue a warrant. A judge then can decide to deny the warrant or grant the warrant. The debtor is brought to the court to kind of, you know, explain themselves, why aren't you paying your debt? And often the person is then jailed for non-payment. So this is the cycle, this is the system that people are navigating as they have this criminal justice debt. And what I think is perhaps one of the most troubling issues is that when you are rearrested, right, so you've gone through this whole process, you failed to pay, you're rearrested, and then you get more criminal justice financial obligations, there's actually no tracking of your previous set of criminal justice financial obligations. So there's no way to actually link your previous debt to your current debt, and you can imagine if the state can't tell you what you owe, how is a person supposed to know what they owe? I'm doing a study right now actually asking people their experience with criminal justice debt. And I'm curious about both what's happening to them and what's happening to their families. because you can see that when you have this debt, it affects every aspect of your life, right? You can have your driver's license can be suspended, your probation parole can be made longer, you can, it ends up affecting your credit score because it, in this world, you can shift from criminal to civil, so it becomes a matter of public record to which credit agencies have access, and so then it's on your credit report, and then it's harder to get some jobs, and it's harder to get a mortgage, it's harder to get a lease. And so I asked people, what was the effect of having criminal justice debt? And you can see that there's some very significant things. You know, people have difficulty getting credit cards and loans. People have had their driver's license revoked. They've had contact with the IRS. Their credit score has been affected. They've been back to court. And one of my outstanding questions is kind of, what is the cost to the state of all of these things? Right, this legislation is very appealing because it's seen as a source of revenue to the state. We'll punish people and we'll make some money. Fantastic. It's a win-win situation from the eyes of the state, right? But the question that has not been answered at all whatsoever is, first of all, the cost of all these people being in debt and the actual financial money involved in all of these things. Like, what does it mean for somebody who can't find employment, who can't find housing, who can't have their own credit card? There's costs involved with that. But nobody is aware of what that is, and I'm trying to figure that out right now. I asked people to just kind of explain to me what the effect of the debt was, and of course they say it's very stressful to keep up with it. They say it's like being extorted by the system, and perhaps of most concern is people express this sentiment that if they're in debt and there's no way for them to get out of it, their only recourse is to perhaps go back to the criminal offenses that they were using before to support themselves. And it's interesting to talk to people because they obviously don't want to do that, but they're feeling this pressure from the state to actually prevent them from being able to successfully reenter society. I also asked people how well you think criminal justice debt accomplish any of these goals of punishment, because that was why we created it, right? We wanted to punish, we wanted to repay the community. And so I asked people with the debt who are supposed to be doing this what they think. And you can see, in general, people think that it does it somewhat poorly. But I actually think it's interesting that this is almost an even split, right? Not everybody is saying, oh, it's horrible at punishment, it's horrible at repaying the community. This is people who are struggling with debt who can still acknowledge that it does actually do some of these things well. And my main takeaway point from that is that there is a way to craft policy that would actually enhance fairness and equity, and that people who have the debt would be able to participate in willingly. But to get there, we need to answer some pivotal questions. First of all, what's the actual extent of the debt? Again, this is something that is unknown. As I said, there's no electronic database. No one agency is tasked with knowing total debt is, right? Because you have probation, you have parole, you have jails and prisons, you have courts, you have child support for some people, right? And nobody knows what the extent of the debt is. We kind of need to know that urgently. You can go bottom up and try to ask people, represent an example of people what their debt is, or try to go top down. And I'm trying to kind of do both of those things right now. Importantly, we need to know how criminal justice financial obligations are actually used in conjunction with prison. And again, this is key because prison is very expensive, and we all know it's very punitive. And are people who are in prison and are coming out, are those the people we also want to punish more with criminal justice debt or not? You know, it's a moral question, it's a policy question, but we just need to know right now to what extent that's happening. We also need to know, as I said before, what's the actual cost to the state of assessing this criminal justice debt and collecting it? Nobody knows. There's a kind of a myopic focus on revenue. We need to know the other side of that equation. And then finally, what's the full extent and nature of the effect of debt on families? Money is one of the interesting sanctions because not only is it both civil and criminal, but it can be served, right, by somebody else. Nobody can actually go to jail for you or go to prison for you, but other people can give you money or pay your debt for you. And that is what, you know, some anecdotal evidence is showing is that, of course, that's what happens. Families help each other out. Family helps you out with your debt. But we don't know to what extent that's happening. Is that everybody? What is the money not being used for in those families? What's the effect on the stability of families? That's another thing I'm interested in trying to find out. Here's just some references and further reading.
So we have about 15 minutes for questions, but I just want to add, I can't emphasize how cutting edge Professor Martin's work really is. I mean, we all know, and we've written about the effects of sentencing on future prospects, the possibilities of future rearrest. But there's very few work that's been done, certainly very little journalistic work that's looked at the effect of public debt, the effect of criminal justice debt. I commend to some of you a recent a study that was done by Oklahoma Watch, which is a journalist, nonprofit journalism website, that looked at the impact in Oklahoma and came up with some really remarkable figures. We have it on the crime report. If you look at last week's crime report, it's a remarkable piece of journalism. So let me go to some questions. We have about 15 minutes, so if you raise your hand, we need short questions. Tell us who you are. Let me go first, start with the back, the lady in the back in the black, and then we'll come forward. Right there.
Hi, I'm Ruth
Tell
Delaney.
Tell us who your question is for or if it's for everyone.
I'm Ruth Delaney. I'm with the Vera Institute of Justice, and I have a question for Al Bloomstein. You mentioned the rise in crime based on the age of baby boomers earlier on your chart, and I was wondering, there doesn't seem to be a similar spike related to the millennial generation, and so I was wondering if you know the millennials, the boom that happened between the early 80s and the early 90s, and so I was wondering if behavior of that generation is different, or if we know anything about that.
Cohort sizes have been impressively flat. We had this big bulge of the baby boomers that started in 46 to 64 and finished. But the millennials have not had a major boom, one way or another. So there was an issue that was raised about the effect of Roe v. Wade as changing the crime drop that we saw in the late 90s, mid to late 90s. But that seems to have not been supported and has certainly not been a continuing issue. The argument being with abortion available, then you had fewer unwanted kids. But that was legal abortion. There was lots of other stuff going on, other forms of family limitation.
I'd like also to comment on you and ask you a question, Al. Coming from Germany and from Europe, you mentioned the big difference that, take Sweden, for example, they have included the jail, 60 people in prison, and you have 750. The big difference between both countries is the punitive attitude of the American people. And where does that come from? The Swedes have a clear answer. They abolished the right of parents to punish their children with corporal punishment in 79. And since then, they reduced the number of, the proportion of kids being punished that way, corporal punishment, to 20%. United States, it's 80%. So the big difference between the European approach to punishment and the American one seems to be that you never thought about of abolishing the right of parents to corporal punishment to kids. So my question is, shouldn't that be added to your long list, good list of things which should happen? Shouldn't you become a little bit more European the way you treat your kids?
That's a fascinating proposal, but there are lots of factors that have contributed to American taste for punishment.
I should add teaching here for a while. I'm going to ask 2,000 undergraduate students here at John Jay about their punitive attitudes and the way they are brought up by their parents. And then we have empirical data, American empirical data.
There's certainly great variety in how parents deal with kids, but so many factors will affect that political environment. One of the issues that I highlighted was that during the 50 years of the stability of punishment, the system was under the control of the criminal justice system. What happened, starting with the politicization of criminal punishment, starting with Barry Goldwater's campaign of crime in the streets, blaming Lyndon Johnson for what turned out to be essentially the baby boomers showing up, we politicized the punishment policy, and the public was ready to go along with it. I don't think it was the public's initiation of it, but the public was concerned and looking to the legislature saying, do something. The legislators, having very limited opportunity to do anything, found sentencing as the vehicle, and so they latched onto that, and that's what contributed to the rise in punitiveness by making it a political issue, and the public applauded. But it was not they who initiated the punitiveness. They initiated the concern, but the political system is what gave rise to the tough on crime. And so one aspect of our society, which is the punishment of kids, is a one of many factors that could contribute, and I would hate to make that the primary.
Yeah, this is from Mr. Bloomstein as well. It's a question about the data. The numbers you showed about the state incarceration rates flattening around 2010, I'm wondering, does that account for...
flattening at 2000.
At 2000, I'm sorry.
Until 13.
And this is kind of an issue important or present in California where I come from. Does that account for the use of private prisons? There's... In California,
the number of people in private prisons.
It does.
Yes.
Okay. Thank you.
It's total incarceration at the state level.
Okay.
Ted Guest from Criminal Justice Journalist. To be a devil's advocate, perhaps with Rick Rosenfeld on the issue of no good data on police involved shootings. Do you think we're ever really going to get this? And I cite the 1994 federal law asking for a study of this was never done because I think the Justice Department said we can't get the data. Isn't the real problem here that we have 17,000 police departments in this country, most of them small, and I don't think there's any federal tradition of requiring any reports from these departments on anything. And as you well know, the uniform crime reports we don't aren't even required. So,
right. The answer is yes. I am optimistic that we will get much. We have no information now, so any step forward, I think, is meaningful. I was at a meeting of the National Academy of Sciences a few weeks ago in which that issue, the issue of wanting more and needing more data, was primary. Representatives of the Bureau of Justice Statistics were there. They plan to move ahead. So exactly how those data will be compiled, I'm not sure. But I'm reasonably certain that BJS is going to spearhead that effort. And that's quite apart from whatever inducement or pressure may come from Congress. And my hope is some inducement plus pressure does come from Congress. And of those 17,000 agencies that technically voluntarily provide their evidence, their crime data to the FBI, the vast majority do so. And we don't need all of them providing use of force data because most police departments have no officer-involved shootings. We need the big city departments to do so, though, and I'm reasonably certain that's going to happen.
I was just going to follow up on this real quick, Adam Gelb at Pew. I remember from back in the late 80s when I was a reporter and covering the Atlanta Police Department, anytime anything happened with a police officer's gun, there was an incident reported and Internal Affairs investigated. Whether it was fired and shot somebody, whether it fired and it didn't hit anybody, or whether, as somebody who sat in the basement reading all the incident reports, whether it fell in the toilet, which they like to refer to as the commode, if the gun fell in the toilet, they had to report that too. And so it just strikes me, it will take many years, and I've spoken with Bill Sable about this, many, many years before there's a national database on this. But that doesn't stop somebody from Sacramento or from wherever from calling your internal affairs departments and getting those numbers. And with those big departments, it's hard. It's just a little hard for me to believe that they're not there. You may not trust them. There may be lots of ins and outs of these, but on a department-to-department basis.
Oh, the data are there. They were there in St. Louis, and the data are very detailed.
Ask who you thought would best maintain that database, but you said the Bureau of Justice Statistics?
Right. I mean, some future database that would compile local-level data. I think Bureau of Justice Statistics by far is the agency. It's the, you know, it's the statistical branch of the Justice Department. That's the appropriate agency, and they have a genuine interest in that.
I guess a follow-up question would be, there was a recent article in the New York Times about this. There's laws, at least in New York State, and I think probably in other states as well, that protect information about police involved in shootings being released, like often like the names of police involved in shootings. Would that get in the way of a database like that?
Possibly, but that law is primarily used to shield departments from releasing the identity of officers. The data I'm talking about don't necessarily have to have officer identity in them. I'm talking about basic descriptions of suspects, victims, officers, number of shots fired, number of persons on the scene. All of that is duly recorded, certainly in the larger departments. I don't think those data are subject to any sort of shield law because they don't reveal the identity of an officer.
I guess I was just wondering if there's somewhere we can go to find your research. Do you have anything published online or anything like that for some of these debt cycles?
For what?
For the debt cycles you were talking about?
No, I don't have anything online, but the my previous slide, there, if you contact me, I can point you in the right direction. Just a lot of my things are in progress, but you know, I'm happy to share some things with you.
Well, the contacts will be in your source notes.
Yeah.
David Greenberg, in talking about the crime trends, you referred to one stretch of time when there was a drop by saying incapacitation. And that raised a couple of thoughts. One is prison populations continued to grow, and let me rephrase that. If we now have the kind of prison drop that you and I would both like to see, why will crime not go up again due to the reduced incapacitation?
Because I think we're seeing much more in the way of risk assessment, and a relatively small fraction of offenders end up contributing a very large fraction of the crime in terms of the offending frequency. We're learning much more about criminal careers, and a small fraction of the offending population contributes a large fraction of the crimes of each type. And so we're going to do a much better job of risk assessment. And what we've seen over the last 5 to 10 years is that a number of states have indeed reduced their prison population and simultaneously reduced the crime rate, in part because the ones that are letting out are the ones who represent a low risk, and they're keeping in the ones who have a higher risk. And admittedly, that is introducing disparity. Disparity was the concern that limited the willingness to do risk assessment, but they now realize that risk assessment is an important part of keeping crime rates from going up. So that as we reduce it and recognize that a large fraction of those drug offenders who are in the prisons are likely not to be doing other crime, particularly if they can get access to some of the treatment resources that are available through public health. So I think we can do a lot of prison population reduction without a comparable bloating of the crime rate. And that's what is driving a lot of the thinking going on of those who are trying to move forward.
So we have time for about three more questions, if they're very quick and short. Beth?
Beth Schwartz Level with the Marshall Project. We tend to talk about the 80s as sort of the bad old days when there was a lot, it was a very violent time, and we look back on it now and think, you know, oh, crime rates have gone down so much, we can now talk about how to reduce incarceration. But the truth is, or isn't the truth, I guess, that we don't really understand why the 80s were so violent. Like, we know that crack had something to do with it. We know that the baby boom had something to do with it. But isn't it true that it's still sort of mysterious why the 80s and 90s were as violent as they were? And the corollary question, I guess, is, can we expect at some point in the future that we'll have some other spike in violence for other reasons that we don't yet understand? And is there a way that we can be better prepared for how to deal with it?
That's a beautiful question. And let me start with the back half. We do a pretty lousy job of predicting economic performance. But we spend an enormous amount of money collecting economic data. And economic phenomena are much simpler in so many ways than crime data. We have so many factors that drive crime. Demography is clearly one of them. Lead in water is another. And there are just lots of factors. And socioeconomic status is an important one. What we saw crime drop during the recession that we didn't anticipate, because past recessions have seen crime rise. So that there are many possibilities by which things can go up, but no one has yet identified when, how, and where it's going to start turning around and going up. That was the second part of your question. The first part was, do we know in retrospect what contributed to the crime drop? I think we have a good sense of that drop in the early 80s being a demographic shift. We have a good sense of the changes that occurred in the late 80s and early 90s, particularly in violence crime, much of that having been associated with the rise in crack markets and the growing prevalence of guns in the hands of people who didn't have guns before and were using it for minor dispute resolution, for gang warfare. And then we saw that change in the crack markets contributing to that major drop in the late. So in retrospect, we don't have it down perfectly. We don't have all the factors in, but we have some pretty good sense of what the most salient factors are, and we're reasonably good at doing that. The forecasting is a much tougher issue, and we've seen lots of forecasts made and proven to be absolutely erroneous, so that people are unwilling to make a lot of forecasts. So I don't know when it's going to turn around, but there's enough fluctuation in a lot of the risk factors that we could indeed see a turn up, but I don't know when or where and how.
So we'll go to one last quick question. Ann?
Hi, I'm Ann Jacobs with the Prisoner Reentry Institute at John Jay College, and I really appreciate the list that Dr. Bloomstein gave us of areas of opportunity as it relates to reducing incarceration. But I want to note that particularly for the high percentage of people who are there on drug crimes, drug treatment is a response for a part of them and a part of their problem. But what I'd like to see on the list and wonder whether you think it's appropriate to include on your list are things both inside and in the deeply affected communities that would increase the employment opportunities or economic alternatives to engagement in the drug trade for people who are doing it primarily as a way of making a living, not having a drug problem at all. So a focus inside, not just on drug treatment, but on education, on job readiness, and in the communities that they're returning to, on there being real economic opportunities for them to make a living.
I think all the discussion in this panel certainly has focused on sort of inner city ghetto problems. And you've identified a whole bunch of them, and addressing them gets at the fundamental question of root causes. And there are so many difficulties in addressing those root causes. They clearly ought to be addressed somehow. And can we consider, for example, the possibility of, for high school dropouts, drafting them into social service functions? That looks like the draft that did an enormous amount of restoring capability for lots of people who were not functioning very well, but got drafted into the Army, got disciplined, and as a means of getting out of this collective environment that is stifling and creating so many of the problems of inner city. So we've got to get some macro possibilities of moving at it, and as we deal with one piece at a time, we ought to do all of that, but we need some major changes, and the changes are going to have to involve some major macro breaking up of some of those inner cities that Rick showed in his graphs of where there's so much concentration, mutual reinforcement, and inability to function in the regular society.
So we had a good, rich morning. I wish we could take some more questions, but we're going to break for lunch now for our fellows and our panelists. But please join me first in thanking our three speakers for a really excellent presentation. And we will reconvene here at 1:30, more or less promptly. So please join us then. Thank you very much.
Those black graphs were so strong.
Great work.
I'm reading so fascinating.
Well, it is changing. I suspect this is the case in Pittsburgh too. You talk about
maybe if you do a and it's both to follow on Ferguson and
Are you going to try it?
I'm going to try. I'd be a little bit, but I'm going to try to get back.
Where'd you get lunch?
Okay.
Where is it?
Upstairs. You should place in the conference down.
So ninth floor?
Yeah, so don't hang out here. We'll keep talking up front.
Are you in Sacramento?
Don't let people distract you.
Region is crepitancies in the United States in punitive kids are treated as rather European. The South, where even the teachers are allowed meat, is very high in punitive.
Just one item. Don't leave any of your personal goods and stuff here. Take them with you, please.
We're putting it together.
Right? You need to like go to LA, two courthouses, okay. Pull 200 right. Records out of how many you know.
I'm out of Elkhart, but anyone, I just want to say it was a privilege to be here.
Well, thank you so much. That's so nice. Well, I got the data and might as well report on it. Thank you very much.
You should keep this for next year. This is an upgrade. I just met Joel Waldman. Joel, he said you are a hero here.
Well,
I said it's so hard for you to come to Pittsburgh. He said, "No, it's too close to heat."
And where are you from?
So I'm a train ride away. You had to make a trip.
Right.
Yes. Okay. You already said. Don't answer it now, but
okay.
I want to see that raw data already. Public radio.